Welcome back, old friends, and if you're new, thanks for joining Ian and I at Down the Pit. My name is Sammy, and today we have a flavorful show. This Grammy Award-winning Argentinian bass player and composer, Pedro Giraudo, helps maintain the special ingredients needed to keep different genres of music like jazz and tango alive while adding his unique flavors. Please enjoy, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review.
We would like to thank our corporate sponsor, US Pave. For any and all your commercial and residential paving needs, please visit us at uspave.com. US Pave, the national paving company. Hey, Pedro, I haven't met you in person, but from all the pictures I've seen, you are a well-dressed man. As a fan of ties, I gotta ask you, how many do you own, including bow ties?
I actually don't know, but certainly too many. That's a fact. And the other thing that might be worth mentioning is that after a concert, we got a review, and it was not mentioned anything about my musical abilities, but yes, about my elegance. So we have that in common then.
Do you know how to tie a bow tie?
Of course I do.
Where do you find your deals?
I'm very good at thrift stores.
Oh, like the Goodwill stores?
Yeah, and some are more kind of vintage. But yeah, I have found a lot of excellent ties there at the Goodwill.
Nice.
Pedro, I've known you for many years now. We come from the same city of Cordoba in Argentina, and you come from a musical family. At what age did you start playing?
Well, I started very, very young. I think it was around 3 or 4 that I started playing the piano. At age 4, we added the violin, but that didn't last too long. I think when I was 6, I quit that. And I continued with the piano until I was 12, where I quit it out of teenagerhood.
And your father here, Carlos, gave Sammy his first gig as a soloist, I believe almost 3 decades ago. Wow. Not trying to make Sammy seem old, but 3 decades is a long time. How did he encourage or influence your first steps in music?
Actually, he was incredibly wise with that. He was not very involved. And I'm telling you that that's very wise because I try to be more involved with my daughters, and that was a recipe for disaster. I almost ruined the relationship to music. I think now I've learned my lessons.
You're a tiger dad?
No, not at all. But when it comes to music, I'm just a horrible, you know, conveying and teaching things. But you know, he just surrounded, going back to my father now, it was a very musical home. I mean, we were constantly surrounded with music of all kinds, you know, from, I remember seeing the LPs of Pink Floyd, Joe Gilberto, Herbie Hancock, Quincy Jones. So it was a really varied music world that I grew up. So I think that was the most important element in my, you know, upbringing, kind of like learning a language, not necessarily having to play an instrument.
And was there a particular type of music you liked as a youngster? You named a few, but was there one in particular that you gravitated towards?
I mean, I can remember as a young teenager, you know, liking, like most teenagers did at that time, you know, Argentine rock. So that's what I did for a long time. And another very wise thing of my father was that he never complained about my musical taste, which now with hindsight, I wonder how he could manage not to say anything. But you know, of course, as you know, most teenagers, I grew up that and was able to improve my musical taste.
Do you have a particular story that reeled you in? Is this kind of hard? Like you said, you know, you're a father and you almost ruin your daughter's or your children's love of music. Since your dad is such a famous musician back in Argentina, to follow in somebody's footsteps is kind of difficult. What allowed you to be reeled into music?
One of the important things is that I never ever felt that. I think so that must have been something, you know, out of the musical world, just my upbringing, that I never felt the need or the weight of his presence. And, you know, it completely different music. And eventually, you know, yeah, he passed away too, very young. I guess, you know, those things help. But, I never felt the pressure of
following in his footsteps.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, that's great. And
then, yeah, never.
So that was not one of your reasons to move to New York?
No, me moving to New York was a combination of different elements. But when I was in Argentina with the hopes of studying both music and engineering. I went to college for a few months, and then I realized that it was impossible to take, you know, do those two careers with some level of decent seriousness. I decided to dedicate my life to music then, and it was actually my grandfather, the father of my mother, who insisted that if I was going to do that, that I should, you know, go to the best place possible to do that. And since I wanted to focus in jazz, I started to look at universities in the US, and I auditioned at a few in, you know, Florida, New York, and Boston. And the minute I stepped on New York, I totally fell in love with the city. So I don't know if that answers your question.
And did the city fall in love with you?
So you went to Manhattan School of Music?
Yep. So I did my undergrad at the Manhattan School of Music, which did mainly as an electric bass player. But it was there that I decided to switch to the acoustic bass, because most of the students there would frown upon the electric bass and prefer the acoustic bass. But it was actually an excellent move, because I fell in love with the instrument immediately, and I decided to continue on that path. Later on, I actually continued to do my master's, and I did that at City College, where I had the privilege to study with Ron Carter for 3 years, which was a huge life-changing experience.
So moving forward, 2018 was a huge year for you. You won a Latin Grammy. Congratulations for Best Tango Album. Was that process enjoyable or stressful for you?
Mainly enjoyable, no doubt about that. It came totally as a surprise, and winning it also came as a total surprise.
So you didn't expect it?
No, I didn't expect the nomination or winning. So both came as a surprise. And of course, I very, very much enjoyed the moment and all that award brought later on.
Did you get to make a speech?
I did.
And how was that?
It was good. I mean, I barely remember anything. My brain was in a completely different space. I just remember looking at my feet while I was walking up to the stage and just like praying that my feet would continue moving, because and this is true. I'm not exaggerating. I was looking at my feet. I was like, okay, just continue walking, do your thing. And then,
Did you have shoelaces? Like, were you worried that you were going to like, oh no, I didn't tie my shoelaces?
No, that didn't happen. But yeah, I had a speech, but my producer very wisely suggested that regardless of, you know, what the outcome could be, that I should prepare a speech so that if I did win, I would not make a fool of myself. So I actually rehearsed the speech, and it came out decently.
Did you reach out to your pocket?
No. I had to memorize it. Yeah, it's very short. So, I mean, okay. I would think that in spite of all the damage that I have done to my brain cells, that a 30-second speech is something that I can still manage.
And did you forget anybody, or everything was cool?
No, I actually forgot. And yeah, it's very, very painful. I forgot my family, which was second on the list. Yeah, I forgot, you know, I started with my wife and daughter, and then it was, you know, my mother and siblings. And I skipped that part, which is something that very much pains me to this day.
So you got a lot of angry texts from people?
No. I think it was mainly myself, you know, carrying that guilt.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
For the rest of your days.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Well, until the next one, then you'll make sure that those people are first on the list.
Absolutely.
So as a band leader, there are many responsibilities. Can you talk about that a bit, and how your mindset is different when you just show up to play the gig or in charge of putting it together?
Oh, it's a huge, huge difference. And the more I work as a band leader, the more I enjoy when I am doing gigs that I'm not a band leader, and I'm just going there and just following the flow, you know, following instructions and being there on time. And that's all I need to do.
And crack jokes in the back with your buddies.
Exactly. But the work as a band leader is pretty brutal, and everybody who does it knows it is. It's you know, spending the whole day in front of the computer, trying to get gigs, signing contracts, working on promotions, pictures, updating the websites, doing social media. I mean, it's just an endless list of really ungrateful tasks.
And how would you describe your leadership style? Are you strict or are you laid back?
Oh, I think Mr. Mardinian here can answer that way better than I. I'm not an objective judge of the situation.
Sami's going to be pretty PC. I want the truth.
He expects the best.
Okay.
He knows that for people to deliver the best, has to be in a laid-back environment. He's got a little bit of both.
Right. Yeah, I think that sums it up. I think I aim very high with our performances. And, you know, until I started the Tang Ensemble mainly, I was a sideman for most of the work that I did. So I know exactly how it feels. And so I do really my very, very best to try to be accommodating, to make everybody feel comfortable. And then on the other hand, of course, I want my band to sound the best I can. So it's a combination of both, as Mr. Merinian here summarized.
So let's say a musician is late to the gig. How do you deal with people like that?
I'm totally fine because Sammy will also know that my record of being on time is not a particularly clean one.
And, so 15 minutes late is on time for you, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, with age, I'm getting significantly better. That's one thing I've been working on, and now I'm most of the time very much on time. But on the other hand, you know, I have my troubled past, and I'm very understanding. I know things, you know, happen, and as long as people show up to the performance itself at the end of it. The other day I had actually a Latin jazz gig that the piano player was late 2 hours, but he showed up 5 minutes before hitting the stage. Mm-hmm. And I was totally fine, you know, as long as the organizer was fine,
totally
I was fine.
Yeah.
You know, I did stress that, you know, he wouldn't show up, but the moment he got there, you know, there was not even
was
one word of complaint on my side. I know things happen. I know people get into trouble.
2 hours.
2 hours.
Wow. 120 minutes. any other fun travel stories?
Well, with Mr. Merdinian here, we have had a lot of good nights in, what was it, Taiwan, Japan.
Erie, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes, that was a particularly good one. So, yeah.
Go ahead. Let's No. You can't gloss over it. Let's hear it.
Let's just say, go ahead.
Yeah, it was, I think, $1 martinis. Let's just say that.
Okay. that's a good start.
And that's where it ends. Moving on. So, Pedro, you've traveled the world quite a bit, and I see on your itinerary that you're a frequent visitor in Japan. Can you tell us about why?
Japan is definitely one of my favorite places to tour, and I've been very, very lucky to perform there many times. My first experiences were actually with the Japanese tango singer, Anna Saeki, and after that, actually, I've been invited to conduct big band a few times, mainly through Miki Hirose, a trumpet player who actually used to play in my big band here in New York and eventually moved back. And then I also did some touring with kind of a virtuoso trumpet player over there who commissioned some pieces for me, Hiro Noguchi. I also toured, actually, I think 4 or 5 times with Tevye Brunetti and Machiko Ozawa. We had a trio called the Urban Tango Trio. Went a few times with Pablo Ziegler. I think one of our last concerts was at the Opera Hall, which was memorable. And last but not least, if I'm not forgetting anything, actually you and I went there with Mr. Del Curto. Was it twice?
Yes.
Twice, yeah. And love to hang out in Japan. My love for cocktails started in Japan. That was the first time that a drink blew my mind. A martini, but very old school, you know, as a drink progressed and evolved during time, the amount of vermouth would diminish until nowadays they usually just kind of wet the glass with it just for aroma and just put just a vodka gin. But back in the day, it used to be half and half, then, you know, 1/3 to 2/3 and so on. And actually, I realized that I'm a kind of old school martini drinker. I like it, you know, 2/3 to 1/3. And the food is incredible. Every theater sounds incredible. The sound crew is amazing. I mean, the whole kind of experience is really, really enjoyable. I think you would agree, Mr. Merdinian.
Yes, absolutely.
How's the sushi?
Amazing. Yeah, but that's the thing. A lot of people just think of sushi about the food in Japan, and that's just like a small part of it. I mean, the culinary tradition is so vast and so delicious and so detail-oriented. Even when they kind of imitate other traditions, like the French tradition, I mean, if you try pastries in Japan, they're incredible. But I actually have been to restaurants which specialize in, for example, cow's organs.
Okay.
So exotic foods. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, for us, exotic. For them, it's, you know, it's a
normal.
It's another kind of restaurant. And
my personal favorites are okonomiyaki.
Oh yeah.
And what is this?
Octopus with wasabi.
Yeah.
Can you rewind 1 second? What is okonomiyaki?
Okonomiyaki is a traditional dish from the southern part of Japan. I think its origins, I might be bluffing here, but I think it's around Hiroshima and around that area. Of course, you can find this dish everywhere. But
I think Osaka has really, really good okonomiyaki.
I think it might be from there. But well, it's a dish that is done fairly quickly, and it's kind of call it a salty, kind of like pancake filled with the
pancake feel to it. But I don't even know if it has gluten, does it?
I have no idea, but it's filled with a lot of different things that it's cooked on a big...
Usually seafood and some like flakes that I'm not sure. Like
the takonomiyaki is with octopus, for example.
So Pedro, are you a big meat eater when you go back to Argentina like Sami is? Because he's introduced me to some interesting different meat. For example, like blood sausage and stuff like that. Are you one of those type of guys that likes to go back to your Cordoba and eat those type of meats?
Actually, there's not much of an option. Truth to be told, I love it. I know here the blood sausage sounds a lot of people frown upon it, but delicious. Actually, the last time I was there, which was somewhat recently in May, I had one. Delicious.
That and the glands and the kidneys.
Exactly.
You know, all part of the tradition.
Yeah, I'm not a big gland guy, but the sausage with the blood in it is actually surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Another question I wanted to ask about Japan is, you said that you went to conduct a big band there. How was it different having your own big band here and going as a guest conductor and having your music performed by musicians there?
Very different experience. The musicianship level over there is really, really good. Unlike New York, where you have to get everything done incredibly quickly, over there is time, people prepare. I mean, they would never show up to rehearsal if they haven't practiced the parts a lot. And over here in New York, I have a band that has been playing my music for almost 15 years. Many of the players are the same. So I have a long-term investment, and that actually comes across in the music. But then in Japan, I had something totally opposite. I had zero of that, but I had the possibility of touring and performing every night and rehearsing a bit every night for maybe 12 days. So I could really work on the details, and all those details were very fresh in all the musicians' minds when we were playing. So I was kind of able to polish the music to a level that in a way I wasn't in New York. But on the other hand, I missed that long-term knowledge of my musical language. I mean, I can think of, the piano player started playing with me in the year 2000. So he knows my language inside out. He knows the colors that I want, the dynamics that I want. And the same thing goes for, 90% of the band. I think the newest member has been playing with me for 3 years. So there were different experiences, but both very satisfying. On the other hand, for example, my experience with the WDR big band was also very different altogether. I was hired there. For the people unfamiliar, the WDR big band is a German state-sponsored big band that has been working, I think, I'm going to make this up, but I'm guessing it must be maybe from the 60s or 70s. And it's a top-notch big band who is constantly collaborating with the very, very best jazz artists in the world. And I was incredibly honored to be called. And over there, you get something very different, which is a band that has been playing together for 4 years that has a sound that in a way you cannot alter it, but you get immediately that sound. It's like going to conduct in a different world, the Berlin Philharmonic. You're not going to change how they sound. I mean, they're going to have that pace and that sound and that depth. But it was also, as a composer, very eye-opening to see how my music could sound, played in a different way, but with a very different depth. Mm. So I had those three very different experiences.
And nobody was late by 2 hours.
No. that was very German in that sense.
Yes.
And same thing in Japan. Nobody was late there.
Yeah, they were probably early, most likely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you show up late too?
No.
No, okay.
And in Japan, actually, I remember the first time I went, I think I showed up like on time, for example, for something. And
you got some dirty looks
by the organizers of Wanasaiki that showing up on time was, being there 15 minutes before.
Gotcha.
Not, if the rehearsal started at 2, it wasn't show up whatever at 2. So yeah, you have to adapt to where you're playing.
It probably has to do a lot also with better transportation, public transportation.
You're making excuses, I see.
No, I'm just saying MTA is not usually the best.
Or you can say that it
Hashtag
almost did MTA. The worst.
After performing and studying tango for 2 decades or so, you started your own tango orchestra, which had its debut at Lincoln Center. What led you to start the Tango Orchestra?
Actually, the reason for me starting is a very sad one, and still that I think about a lot. Actually, yesterday I spent a lot of time thinking about it. What happened is that I played with an extraordinary pianist, Octavio Brunetti, who was a very dear friend, and he passed away. And so Lincoln Center asked me to do something like a tribute for him. And that was what triggered me to start the Tango Orchestra. And the call happened in 2014. And we had our debut concert in 2015. But yeah, the reasons for me to start this project are somber.
Yeah, he was extraordinary, as you said, like pianist, and we all miss him very much.
Kudos, though, to Lincoln Center for doing that, though. Not many people get tributes when they pass away.
Absolutely. That was a beautiful gesture of Lincoln Center. I think it was a great way to celebrate his life and his very important legacy.
Do you feel more comfortable leading smaller groups like your quartet or orchestras like the Tango Orchestra or big bands?
My mental process is exactly the same. There's no difference at all when I'm conducting the big band or the Tango Quartet at the performance or at the rehearsal. The process is exactly the same.
Just more people that could be 2 hours late.
Absolutely. But actually, I have to say that in spite of the amount of people, the big band tends to be incredibly on time. It's very rare to have somebody not show up on time.
So they're usually waiting for you?
That has happened many times, I have to say. Although, you know, I think I've never been late. Is that true? I don't know if that's true. But more often than not, there are people that are there before I get there.
So how does somebody get in your doghouse? I mean, you said 2 hours is fine, but let's say I'm 3 hours late to the gig. Are you going to give me a call back or that person a call back? Like, what does that person have to do in order to upset you?
Or forgets the music?
I think I tend to be very forgiving because I've done all of those things that you just mentioned. I've been late. I have forgotten my music.
Check.
Exactly. So I think it's... I mean, if it's something very recurring, for me, it's more the very few times that I had to change personnel in my bands, it was a purely musical choice. It was because the music was not working out. So I guess the answer is I've never had somebody show up 2 hours late to a gig 5 times in a row. That happened only once. And I know the people that I work with are very professional, and sometimes they run into things, they run into traffic, they have family issues, and it just happens. So I think the 3 times I had to do personnel changes in my ensembles were strictly because of musical reasons.
So you obviously trust the people that you work with. Let's say you have to work with a sub. Let's say somebody's sick sometime, or one of the 3 times you had to make a personnel change. Does that slow the process of putting together a dynamic show on? Or does it make the show a bit more stressful?
Let me answer that with a long answer. At this point, with both the big band and the Tango Ensemble, I have several, let's call them trained or subs that are totally familiar with the repertoire. There are very few times, one actually happened somewhat recently, where I had 5 performances with a brand new pianist who had never played the music before. And for the first, I would say, rehearsal, I get stressed just to see if the upcoming concerts are going to be a disaster or not. But that rarely has happened. At this point, I have a few subs for every single chair, and I know that the show will be totally fine and I can do as I usually do.
Yeah, you know what you're getting.
Yes.
All right, well, we're going to move on to our first espresso section. We're just looking for the first words that come to your mind. Are you ready?
Deal.
Okay, favorite instrument beside the bass?
When I think about it, it's the piano, but the first one that came to mind is the violin.
Favorite tango composer?
Julian Plaza.
Favorite jazz musician?
Ellington.
Favorite band leader?
Hector Del Curto has been a band leader I've learned a lot from. And Brad Meldo is somebody that I admire that continues to reinvent himself in many ways and always leads very interesting projects.
Favorite performance you've had?
That's impossible to answer. I had many goosebump moments, so yeah, very difficult.
Favorite tango dancer?
Miriam Larici and Leonardo Barrionuevo.
Favorite traditional tango?
Danzarin by Julian Plaza.
Favorite bass solo that you've had in a song?
Tanti anni prima by Astor Piazzolla with arrangement by Octavio Brunetti.
Favorite composer, alive and not?
So obvious, not alive, Bach. I still, until 2:30 a.m., listening to some of his cantatas last night. And alive, the one that comes to mind immediately was Esa-Pekka Salonen. That was a concert that I watched with the New York Phil that blew my mind.
Nice. Favorite food?
Ramen.
Favorite TV series?
I don't watch much TV, but I guess Friends. So that tells you a bit of how updated I am with
that. Favorite movie?
Super cliche, sorry. Godfather.
Favorite actress?
Kate Winslet. What blew my mind was when I saw her do a theater piece, I think it was A Streetcar Named Desire. It was mind-blowing.
Favorite politician?
Bernie Sanders.
Okay. Favorite hobby?
Running. I don't know if that counts as a hobby.
Yeah, of course. Favorite cartoon when you were a kid?
Popeye.
Maradona or Messi?
No question about it, Maradona.
How about a cocktail?
Tons, actually. You just touched a very sensitive topic. Via Carré, Manhattan, Negroni.
Favorite beer?
Belgian triples usually hit the spot.
And last but not least, a useless talent that you have.
I'm annoying.
Okay, I mean, I guess
take
we can.
That or
no, that's a little
deeper.
How are you annoying? Like, what are you annoying about?
Okay,
I guess.
Okay, then let's look for something else.
You want me to give you ideas? I mean, maybe if I say something that'll trigger. Yeah, so we've had, like, our old roommate used to be able to do the wave with his stomach. We've had people that can, like, memorize the back of LPs, the whole entire back of stuff. Useless information.
We had someone that used to catch
tater tots from 50 yards away with his mouth. Does this help?
Not at all. Useless talents. I'm sure it must be a collection of those, but I cannot think of one.
Double jointed fingers. Make one eyebrow higher than the other.
Nope.
With your tongue, can you roll your R's? Can you make designs out of your tongue? Like some people could do flowers.
Nope. Well, it's not really useless, but I'm very good with plants.
Okay.
Plants, yeah. Actually, I can keep them alive for a fairly long amount of time.
Yes, that's useful, but I mean, listen. Depends who you ask.
I agree with the part of it not being useful, but yeah.
If it's, yeah.
Okay, we'll take it. So let's transition into your sound and your compositions. As a composer, you have been said to write plush harmonies. Do you have a particular chord that is the Pedro chord or a particular harmony?
Well, yes, and it's not mine, but I definitely overuse it. Mm-hmm. Which is a dominant chord with the altered ninths and augmented fifth. That's something that the Thad Jones, Ben Lewis big band used often, and also Piazzolla didn't use as often, but used. So that's something that collides.
So it's kind of like a pivot chord between both genres.
Exactly.
And that's your distinct sound? So like when someone's listening to your piece, they're like, aha, that is the Pedro chord.
Well, I think my music comes across, it's recognizable not because of a chord. I think it's very motivic. When people have told me that they have recognized my music when they didn't know about it, it was because of how the music flows rather than something very vertical as a chord. But there's definitely both my big band and my tang ensemble use that chord a lot. I mean, I would recognize it when I hear it. It's like, oh yeah, that I use that sound a lot.
Do you have a lot of like Argentinian folk influence in your music? Or since you moved to New York at such an early age, you don't show that in your music so much?
No, quite the opposite. I think moving here was something that triggered me to go back emotionally to, and also in terms of information, to Argentina and explore all these very rich traditions and use them much more. So, and I did not move at that early age. I was 19, so a lot of my life-shaping years were down in Argentina. But since I moved here, actually, I've done a lot of research into the traditional music of Argentina, both the urban tango and the more rural folklore.
Wonderful. And now that we have been talking about your music, it would be nice to listen to it. So what better way to end part one of our conversation with you by showcasing your music? This is Con un nudo en la garganta, or With a lump in the throat, Pedro Giraudo and his jazz big band from his 2006 album Desconsuelo. If you like the show, please show us some love by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review. Stay tuned for part two, but for now, please enjoy the music. Thank you. thanks so much for sticking around until the end and allowing us to be a part of your day. We don't have all the solutions to the world's problems, but classical music for sure can help solve a few of them. Please follow us on social media, and we cannot wait for you to join us next time.